You are listening to a sermon by Dave Dewert, recorded on Sunday, October 23, 2011, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Thanks for the invitation to share with you. So this is an interesting passage, I think. Let me set it in the context that Luke sets it in. At this point in the gospel, Jesus and his followers are on their way. They've been on a journey from Galilee down towards Jerusalem. And remember, Jerusalem was the seat of political and economic power for this provincial region of the Roman Empire. And there seems to have been among the followers a sort of heightened anticipation in terms of what this might occasion, this entrance into Jerusalem. Perhaps there was some thought that the rabbi from Galilee was going to take hold of the machinery of power in Jerusalem and establish the reign of God, at least from the disciples arguing who's going to be first in the kingdom and who's going to sit on the right and the left and so on, sort of a kind of idea of how this might unfold. But of course, Luke sets up a series of encounters and events as they journey through Galilee to Jerusalem. And reading those encounters, you get a bit of a different story. So, for example, Jesus meets a number of people, a variety of people. And along the way, he consistently positions himself alongside the small, like children, the weak, so a blind man that he meets, or even outcasts, like the tax collector Zacchaeus. And at the same time, he challenges those with social status, like Pharisees or people with political and economic power, like the wealthy ruler that he encounters. And it seems that there's a bit of a disconnect between where Jesus positions himself as he encounters these folks and what the disciples see. For example, on the way, they try to stop people from bringing the children to him. They also tell the blind guy to shut up as he's calling out, and they grumble that he goes to the home of a tax collector. So they seem to be out of sync with what Jesus is trying to do here. And when he tells the wealthy ruler to give all of his possessions to the poor, they're a bit stunned. I mean, after all, this would have been a great occasion to solicit support for the movement. So in the midst of all of these events, Jesus offers a prediction, his own prediction, of what's going to transpire in Jerusalem. He says, "See, we're going up to Jerusalem, and everything that is written about the Son of Man by the prophets will be accomplished. He'll be handed over to Gentiles. He'll be mocked and insulted and spat upon. After they have flogged him, they will kill him, and on the third day he will rise again." Luke tells us that the disciples didn't really understand what that meant. And undoubtedly, it's because they were infused with a different set of expectations for this trip south. Now, the passage immediately before the one we read is the story of Zacchaeus. And this is, I think, really important. Zacchaeus is a wealthy tax collector living in the city of Jericho. As a tax collector, he is a collaborator with the imperial power, with Rome and its political and economic interests. And he's also working with local administration that is in control of the region. For that reason, I think, he is viewed by the local population as someone who exploits, someone who is therefore despised by people. And then it's even more surprising that Jesus arranges to stay with Zacchaeus. And he, in that sense, transgresses the boundary of social stigma that Zacchaeus had. And he challenges his outcast status. In fact, they're all shocked. It says that they were shocked, saying, "He went to spend time in the house of this person. This is incredible. But at the conclusion of Jesus' time with Zacchaeus, Zacchaeus promises to redistribute his wealth, give half to the poor, and to make restitution for anything he's taken unjustly, up to four times as much. And this announcement by Zacchaeus, we don't know what they talked about, but this was the announcement at the end, the response by Jesus is to say that Zacchaeus is going to experience and is experiencing salvation as a result of his action. So what does that mean, salvation? Well, maybe talking about Zacchaeus' own deliverance from the soul and community-destroying practices of unjust wealth accumulation that is backed by ruthless military and political power. And also freedom from personal alienation and communal disdain. And in that sense, Zacchaeus experiences this salvation that constitutes the establishment of justice in the community and equality through this redistribution and restitution and the healing of community hostility between them. And so this is the, I think, the shape of deliverance, what it looks like for those who are managers and mediators of imperial power, tangled in the structures that serve the interests of the elite and those who oppress and exploit the majority. What does it look like to experience deliverance as part of this movement of Jesus? And Zacchaeus becomes sort of the paradigm of that. And so we leave that story and emerge onto the one that is being told that we read this morning. And I think it's really important that this parable that we've heard is framed initially as Jesus speaking to the crowd just as they leave Jericho, just as they leave this scene with Zacchaeus. And so they're leaving Zacchaeus' home and in Jericho, and they're continuing their journey to Jerusalem. And Luke prefaces the recounting of the parable itself with indications that it followed quickly on the heels of the conversation with Zacchaeus. And so he says, as they, that is the people with Jesus, were listening to this, that is Jesus' words about Zacchaeus. So it kind of ties it to this previous episode. And then also Luke says that the parable was really motivated by their proximity to Jerusalem on the one hand. He says, because he was near Jerusalem. And he ties it to the crowd's anticipation of what was about to happen, because they supposed that the kingdom of God was about to appear immediately. So I think it's really important that we read this parable within these parameters. That is, they're moving into the realm of concentrated political and economic power in Jerusalem. And those accompanying Jesus imagined that he would immediately take control in some ways, that the kingdom of God would come, maybe by his taking control of the apparatus of power. Their expectations of what awaited them in Jerusalem, of course, is at odds with Jesus' own understanding of what lay ahead of him, which was arrest, torture, and death. And so it's in the context of these, all of this tension, this anticipation, this expectation, this clash of empires, if you like, the clash of kingdoms that lies ahead. It is in this intense atmosphere that Jesus tells the story. And this story, I think, is meant to elucidate the dynamics of imperial power and sets up this sets the stage for his arrival in Jerusalem. And so the parable goes that there's a nobleman, someone who's well-born, an aristocrat, if you like, one of the elite, goes to a distant country to get royal power, or specifically to get a kingdom, Basileia, for himself, and then to return. So he's really the central figure of the parable, someone who is among the elite, belongs to the nobility, born into an aristocratic family. Obviously a person of status, person of wealth and power within his own local region. And the story opens with this character then on a journey to the center of imperial power to get for himself an endorsement, an authorization to rule his local region as a king. Now, the dynamics here are pretty simple. And in fact, this was done by Herod the Great, who was called King Herod.
He was a local Idumean aristocrat, wealthy person. Rome validated him as the ruler, and Rome did this for its outlying regions, the outlying regions of the empire. Is that they often simply endorsed or authorized a local wealthy aristocratic elite to run the area to serve their interests. In other words, to extract resources through taxes and make sure that the population was submissive. And so here we have a scene exactly like that. And you can see this happening if you read Josephus's account, for example, the first century Jewish historian of Herod's son Archelaus. This is exactly what he did. He was the son of King Herod. When Herod dies, he goes to Rome to be given Herod's kingdom, being validated as the one to take over for his father as king. So this scenario is something pretty familiar to what transpired there at that time. And the theme, really, of this parable, because it keeps coming up, is the word kingdom, or kingly rule, or to become king. So it's all this language of Basileia. And this is the setting, of course, is that there was this anticipation that the kingdom of God was going to be established as they entered Jerusalem. And Jesus tells a parable of another kind of kingdom. We have to recognize, he says, I think this is what he's saying, we have to recognize the kind of kingdom we're about to confront. And so this is what the story exposes: ruthless nature of political kingdoms and those who rule them, and the dynamics of power and violence that is at work within these imperial arrangements. And so into this matrix of imperial power and its local manifestation, Jesus and his company are about to enter in Jerusalem. So the parable then says, this guy heads off to get this kind of royal power and endorsement, and he summons 10 slaves, gives them some money, and says, do business until I come back. Now, this is a pretty common feature of a sort of noble estate where there would be a number of servants to carry out the household duties and promote the interests of the owner of this estate. And so they're given the authority to manage the household and to do business, carry on the business affairs of the master, and to ensure that his interests in maintaining his status and his wealth were actualized, were promoted, and so on. And so he gives them money, not a lot of money, actually, in this account. It's maybe, I don't know, the equivalent of $20 or something, and says, carry out business while I'm gone. And of course, they would have understood that, you know, we know how the master operates, we know what his interests are, we know that the way he works and what his expectations will be. And so they do business along the lines of the way he would do business. And so to further his interests and increase his wealth according to his expectations. Now, this all sounds fine, but then this story adds another kind of another person on the drama, or collective person on the drama, and that is the citizens of his country, we're told. The citizens of his country hated him, and they sent a delegation after him that was going to follow him to the imperial center and counter his efforts to become king by saying, we don't want this guy to rule over us, to rule as king over us. And so this is really an interesting dimension to the parable, because I think what it shows is that the population of the region was not so keen on having him rule. They understood that this person acted in abusive and exploitive ways towards the population, and they despised them. They no doubt were fearful that if he was successful in this trip, in procuring imperial authorization to impose on them his rule, then their hardship would be unbearable, that he would exploit and oppress them even more. And so they act to subvert his mission, and they send their own delegation to persuade the imperial authorities that he shouldn't be given this kind of endorsement. Perhaps they say something like, you know, given the local animosity between the ruler and the population, this would only be trouble for the empire. You really shouldn't give him royal power. In any case, they send their representatives and try to stop him in this effort. But it says, when he returned, having received royal power, they failed. They weren't successful in persuading the imperial authorities otherwise. So when he returns, after succeeding in becoming king, then he has to solidify his rule. And this needs an administration for his kingdom. He has to administrate now the affairs of this local population. And so he summons his servants because he wants to know who acted in compliance with his interests, who can be trusted. He wants to ascertain their loyalty, their effectiveness in implementing his political authority and control. They're going to be part of his new royal administration now. And so he summons his servants. And the first servant reports a tenfold profit that he gained from the resources that were entrusted to him. And, you know, no doubt this kind of profit in his business affairs were as a result of implementing the tactics of the master, which, judging from the population and their disdain of him, entailed aggressive and exploitative means, I'm sure. But the master praises the servant, using language of affirmation and approval, and he's done his work to the satisfaction of the master and shown himself to be trustworthy, and so is given authority to govern over a number of cities in the region. Second guy comes, and likewise, he was able to procure a certain level of profit that shows that he is also trustworthy in promoting the master's economic interests, and as a result is given a position of administrative oversight in this new kingdom. Well, there are 10, but the other 8 are not really talked about much except for one. And this third one that is mentioned is a bit unusual. And we can assume the other folks, the other 7, were also compliant with the master's wishes. But this servant is singled out. And apparently he took a different tactic. And he wrapped up the money that was given to him and kept it safe, kept it out of circulation. He didn't multiply the master's wealth in sort of money-making schemes at the people's expense. Rather, he took the master's money out of circulation completely so that it couldn't be employed in oppressive or exploitive ways. And the other thing that's interesting about this servant is that he actually offers an explanation for that. He describes why he undertook this kind of unusual action. Claims that he was afraid of the master, or maybe afraid of what the master would do with this increased wealth. And he accounts for the basis of his fear. He says that, at least from this servant's perspective, the master is a harsh, austere person who makes money from unjust investment schemes, exploits others. He reaps the benefits of their labor and demands beyond what is fair. So this idea, you reap what you didn't sow, you take what you didn't deposit. These are expressions of exploitation. These are expressions of oppressive economic strategies. And so he names it. You know, talk about this expression of speaking truth to power. That's what this servant does. And so he exposes the master's oppressive use of power to gain wealth. And he chooses a path of nonconformity. I'm not participating in that mode of operation and that system of oppression. And his act of removing the money from the business practices of the new king was a refusal to play the game of abusive power. So in this sense, he defects from participation in these modalities of elite power, and his non-compliance with the master's demands and mode of operation really, in many ways, aligns him more with the population who were trying to stop him from becoming king, this guy from becoming king, than with the other servants. And this is, I think, an interesting image of a sort of defection from the empire on the part of sort of middle managers, if you like. So what does the master do? He responds by saying, you wicked slave, if you knew that I was this kind of person, then and he repeats it exactly, that I take what I didn't deposit, reap what I didn't sow, then why didn't you just put it in the bank and get collect interest? So the master's not impressed. The slaves that brought him a profit were good, but this one is wicked, and he denounces him, shames him, vilifies him for not acting in the master's own economic interests. He's a deviant servant, he's reprehensible, and so on. And he even admits, by repeating it, he even admits the characterization that the servant voiced about how this master operates. He is somebody who's harsh, austere, who's unjust in business dealing and exploits others. But given this, the servant should at least have deposited it where they could have generated interest, even though Leviticus 25 says you're not to charge interest. And so this is the response of dissent. Non-compliance and a defection from the system of power within which he's embedded. So what does the master do? He says, take the pound from him and give it to the one who has 10 pounds. This is quite... There's another thing that's fascinating about this parable at this point, because then there's a little bracket, a little parenthesis, where Luke inserts, and they said to him, they, I think the bystanders, said to him, Lord, he has 10 pounds. So even the people standing around are sort of shocked that the master took this money from this guy and gave it to the person who has the most. And so this closing scene of the parable, I think, is meant to disclose even more the brutality of this local elite turned king and the nature of his kingdom. So he punishes nonconformity to his ways by taking the money from the deviant servant and giving it to the one who displayed the greatest business ability and administrative loyalty. And even the bystanders are shocked by this. So we can see the master here, it's not about fair and even distribution, but about rewarding those who are most effective in promoting and expanding his system of power. And then we get this maxim that sort of lays bare this basic principle that seems to be operating in the kingdom of this particular master, namely, to those who have, more will be given, and from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken from them. So those who prove themselves successful in the structures erected to benefit elite privilege will acquire ever-increasing wealth and power, while those who struggle to survive or those who oppose such a regime will experience increasing loss and hardship. And then in the final instructions, if we didn't think this master is awfully brutal at this point, in the final instructions from the master, he turns to the delegation of people who had argued against his installation as king, and he construes them as enemies. He says, as for these enemies of mine, he sees them as opposed to his position of power because they knew only too well the hardship and the abuse that such power would entail. And for these people, he orders a violent execution to be carried out, he says, even in his presence. Perhaps to show that, you know, maybe to make sure his orders were fulfilled, but also maybe to indicate his own sort of intoxication with his newly legitimated power, which entailed power to destroy. So this parable, I think, on the cusp of entering Jerusalem, exposes a king and a kingdom marked by hierarchical power exploitation, oppression, and violence. And those who dissent from this kind of kingdom will be punished, whether they be middle managers who fail to follow the dictates of economic aggression and success, or members of the population who oppose the injustice and the brutality of official imperial arrangements. Then the parable just ends by saying, after he had said this, so this is Luke's comment, after he had said this, he went on ahead going up to Jerusalem. That's the whole point. This parable, it seems, is a comment of what they're about to face when they reach Jerusalem. It's the proximity to Jerusalem that is this the sort of the spark for the telling of this story, says Luke. They were going up to a place where the dynamics of power that are revealed in the parable are fully operative. The kingdom of God, however, not the basileia of such a ruler as depicted in the parable, but the kingdom of God, as announced and embodied in Jesus, was one that was marked by solidarity with outcasts, the weak, and the poor. And it challenged the dominant structures of power and those who perpetuated and benefited from it. Jerusalem would be the site of the clash between kingdoms and loyalties. And rather than seize the apparatus of authority, as his followers might have expected, Jesus would experience the brutality and violence of state-sanctioned execution. Yet against this apparent triumph of imperial power, the death of this one, the human one, the Son of Man, the human one, would not be the last word. The movement of liberation that he launched, the order of outcasts that he inaugurated, and would continue to disturb and disrupt the contours of elite political power through this strategy that Jesus embodied throughout his entire life and work, this strategy of nonconformity to those contours of power that operated in Jerusalem and operated in Rome. And they were based on, this kingdom of God, based on these communal practices of solidarity with the poor, just and equitable distribution of resources, and compassionate care for one another. And this is the mode of descent. I think the parables... I've gone on too long. Just a couple of closing reflections. Parables offer new ways of seeing. I think that the telling of parables is a way of exposing realities that are often hidden from view because of social and cultural processes of normalization. And in that exposure of these realities, they challenge them. And if we employ this parable as the lens through which to see how political and economic power works and what happens when people dissent or defect from it, what do we see? Of course, we don't live in a culture of kings and royal power, but we do inhabit a world of other kinds of concentrated power, whether it be corporate power or state power, military, judicial power, law enforcement, media power. There's all kinds of these modes and nodes of concentrated power. And so the parable challenges us to consider how this power operates, who wields it, whose interests it serves, and who plays the functional roles of mediating that power, and then, on the other hand, who suffers from the way in which it's organized and employed. And the parable and its surrounding context, I think, also helps us to visualize our own loyalties. It assists us to determine where we stand in the contours of dominant power, how we are related to it, what defection might entail. If our fundamental loyalty is to this alternative reality of the kingdom of God, as Jesus embodied and enacted, then where does that place us in relation to the kingdoms, the concentrations of power in our world? So like the followers of Jesus, we might want to assume that the two kingdoms can be fused together somehow, that the disciples could simply take over the mechanisms of power offered by the systems in place in Jerusalem. But the early witnesses of Jesus testify to his place as victim, not heir, of the dominant political structures in Jerusalem. Where then does that position us as the followers of Jesus in our relationship to the reigning political and economic power systems of our world? Like Zacchaeus, salvation means defection from the system of exploitation and abuse of power, and it takes the form of alternative practices of just redistribution of resources and restitution for injustices committed. Defection is possible, but the cost is considerable. I think it's only in solidarity with outcasts and the excluded, with those who suffer most from the dominant system of power, that we can imagine resistance and the path of liberation. How we might embody a life of defection and dissent, one step at a time. How we might establish communities of resistance and dissent and the embodiment of alternative practices of justice and care. And so realizing our embeddedness is the first step to liberation. But we need to take up steps and ways of non-compliance and alternative modalities of living marked by inclusion, by generosity, by justice and compassion. And in this way, the other kingdom, the one inaugurated by Jesus, will seep into the world, and with it, the experience of life in abundance rather than scarcity and death. So we need imagination and we need courage to live into this reality, and we need to undertake this way of life together, collectively, as well as individually. Well, anyways, those are my thoughts.